All right. Welcome, everyone, to episode 18 of the USC Honesty Hours podcast. We're a podcast that dives into the importance of mental health and facilitates honest conversations about it. Our mission is to highlight the importance of keeping a healthy mind and make those uncomfortable conversations about mental health comfortable. We want to really foster an environment at USC that destigmatizes mental health challenges and encourages individuals to reach out for help. I'm James Lai, and normally I'd be joined by my co-host, Vianney Eusebio, but she is feeling unwell at the moment, so let's hope she feels better and is able to join us on our next episode. I'm joined here by Dr. John Walsh, our guest speaker for today, who is an associate professor of gerontology and neuroscience and the assistant dean of gerontology here at USC. Good afternoon, Dr. Walsh. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me, James.
Awesome. And before we dive into our questions, let's both share one thing that inspired or touched us recently. And I can start with this. I think I saw this a couple weeks ago, and I think this was a quote from, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Marcus Aurelius. And I think it really speaks to the importance of perspective. But I think it went a little bit something like, choose not to be harmed, and you will not be harmed. Don't feel harmed, and you won't be. And that really struck me as it really speaks to kind of how important perspective is when you're approaching perhaps a difficult situation or mental health challenges. But I do think sometimes it can be difficult to do that. So something that I've been thinking about.
Cool. I mean, the similar adage that I have in my life, and you know, and I have my own personal therapist, my wife, who we've been together 40 years, but it's a saying we have is you can't control what people do to you, but you can control how you react.
Absolutely. All right. Well, how about the audience at home? How about you? Think about something that has recently inspired or touched you.
So you're talking to me now, right, James?
Yes, right after this. Okay. Now we're going to jump into our questions.
Awesome. Right. So what has inspired me or touched me? I made mention to my wife, I've always been inspired by just how, you know, not only successful she is and how bright she is, you know, but she's also, you know, she handles a lot, you know, and she's very, very compassionate. But also, you know, super fair in how she deals with the mental health issues and the individual needs and problems that students have, you know, at USC. And I'm always inspired by my students as well, for sure. You know, it's a tough time right now, and there's a great group of students that are putting out a serious effort right now, and it makes me want to do what I do even better. So how about that?
that's great to hear. That's great to hear. And now let's jump into our questions. So I guess just to start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you found your way to your career in gerontology?
Right. So I grew up east side of LA. I actually grew up in Monterey Park and came from a very, very simple means. I was the first in my family to go to college, and we had a little two bedroom, one bath, with three boys kind of scenario. I grew up not too far from East LA College, basically right there at Floral Drive and Atlantic Boulevard. I have a very close core group of friends that we formed back then in the 70s, and we're still friends. We're all a bunch of surfers, and we still surf together. But I was the one person in the group where school came a little easier for me. and so I went to UC Irvine undergraduate, and I was a biology major. It's hard. There's more pressure on you guys now than back in my era, for sure. And I was really immature, and I wasn't ready for it, but I still persevered ended up getting a 3.0 GPA at UC Irvine, but it was I had to do a serious self-evaluation at the end of my sophomore year, where I had about a 2.2 GPA. And it's just hard growing up. But I worked in a laboratory. It was a neuroscience laboratory at UC Irvine. And from there, I went to grad school. I decided to leave my surfing behind me, because I knew that I was not going to go anywhere, at least at the academic level, if I kept doing what I was doing. And so I went to University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine for 2 years. And then my mentor, my boss — you have a private investigator that you work under — he moved his program to University of Texas School of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And so I went down there, and that's where I got my PhD. I spent 3 years in Houston. It's also where I met my wife. And I specialized in learning and memory, and specifically looking at how individual connections in the brain are modified during the memory process. And then I moved over to UCLA at the Neuropsychiatric Institute for a postdoctoral fellowship, where I studied that process in brain areas that are particularly impacted by Parkinson's disease and stroke. And so from there, I got some notoriety, and then I got a job offer at USC. It was really — I hadn't applied for the job, but it was, had a great working relationship with somebody, and this is how the life is, connection — somebody who was married to a professor at the School of Gerontology, and they were in the mid-search trying to find somebody to do brain research in areas related to Parkinson's. And so it worked, and that was 30 years ago. So I had a pretty thriving laboratory for about 25 years, and then I had to let it go for personal reasons. But I teach, and I love teaching. I was referred to you by Kenna, and there's a lot of people that take my class. It's a great class. It's called A Journey into the Mind. It's a GE class. So that's the story of how I got here.
Awesome. That's great to hear. In terms of like your surfing background, who do you think — I'm not super into surfing. I've watched a little bit here and there, but who would you say is like your favorite surfer?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the GOAT, undoubtedly. So Kelly Slater is an absolute phenom. You think of the Tom Brady's and the Michael Jordans, and if you knew surfing, you would realize Kelly Slater has done twice what those guys have done. He's phenomenal to watch, at his age. He's just incredible. And it's a very, very — at the level of surfing that the professional surfers do, it's a very life-threatening sport, and they — huge waves breaking in a foot of water over a solid jagged rock or jagged coral reef, and it's incredible what they're able to do. They're fearless, and the skill that he has, at his age is amazing. And Kelly Slater is, I believe, 50 years old, and he's phenomenal. He's phenomenal, and it's mostly a young man's sport. If you look at professional surfing, it's people usually in their late teens to late 20s, and then that's it. So he's pretty phenomenal. There's younger guys that I like watching too, but he's pretty phenomenal.
Got it. And in terms of gerontology, to my knowledge, gerontology is, all about, aging and old age in general, if that's correct. Was this something that you've been interested, all throughout your life, maybe your childhood?
No, not really. I mean, as a childhood, I was just that kid that really found anything that was life sciences related really fascinating. So that was why I became a biology major. And being a specializing in physiology was really understanding how all the parts really work well. But it was more — I remember telling my wife, I got my PhD, and And then I did 5 years postdoc at UCLA, and I was looking for a job. And I remember telling her, you know, I really don't know where I'm going with this, but I'm not leaving Southern California. I already did that, and I was really back in the groove surfing again. And my personal life was really, my professional life was important, but maintaining my personal life, to me, to be happy and fulfilled was super important. And so when FC contacted me and said, hey, will you apply your skill set to studying aging in these brain areas? I said, for sure, why not? And then I had a 30-year career doing it. So
that's great to hear. Seeing how you were able to really balance your personal life and, you know, being out there in the waters, but also being able to pursue your professional kind of aspirations. That's great to hear. And moving on from that, more generally speaking, what has working in gerontology taught you about mental health overall? And can you start us off with maybe a short biological explanation of what causes anxiety, depression, some of these mental health conditions?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely biological in nature. It's not something that is, a psychological defect that you can fix. You know, it's something that is biological. There are psychological methods of basically using learning and memory tools, cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's biological plasticity that can help remedy some of the issues, but it's very organic in nature is what I'm getting at. So whether, you know, if you look at clinical depression and anxiety disorders, there can be a genetic predisposition. You know, so the way your genes and proteins are produced, you know, and it's an orchestration. You know, it's mind-boggling. You know, when you think about every single day the amount of proteins that are turned over and replaced and how they're positioned in just the right amount. You know, and you know, we have 100 billion nerve cells in our brain. You know, trillions of connections, and to have it work out and be okay is phenomenal unto itself. But it's very clear that people that have anxiety disorders, clinical depression, people that have ADHD, that these bits and pieces are not being assembled correctly. And we know for sure that there are deficits in kind of like, it's kind of volume control, I'd call it, you know, and it's, you know, most of us heard about the dopamine system and the reward you get, the bursts of dopamine when things are going right. And then the other one is the fight or flight, you know, the adrenaline rush. And there's a form of adrenaline that's in the brain as well. And the way these are released and the way they're perceived are just different in people that have these problems. And so that's why when you look at the drugs that are prescribed by physicians, by psychiatrists, they're targeting dopamine, they're targeting serotonin, they're targeting adrenaline in the brain. It's called noradrenaline. There's no free lunch when you're taking a pill and you're going after a desired behavior. There's lots of side effects, you know. So, and that's why it's super important to couple it with seeing a therapist, psychologist, or a psychiatrist that you then train, you know, just like, you know, I saw you're a business major, James, you know, and so you're training right now to be competitive in the business world. Well, you train yourself and how to deal with problems, you know? So it's, you know, it's a struggle. It's a life journey for people to have this. So that's kind of the debate, you know, background behind it. With respect to gerontology, if you look at over the life course, your brain is undergoing major development right now, James. And so it starts post puberty. And so for a good 10 years, you know, it's going from say 15 to 30 years of age, the part of the brain that is evaluating in how well you fit into the world. And you think about that, then that's going to have, when it's pathological, pathological. It's going you're going to have anxiety because you don't fit, or you're going to be depressed because you don't fit. Okay. The inattentiveness of ADHD, this is all because this front part of the brain is the last part to develop. So it's undergoing major, major change right now in you guys. And so when we look, go back to aging, so this is a continuum. So this is when the absolute peak for these affective disorders of depression, anxiety, and ADHD are happening. They're happening now from 15 to 30 years of age. And so, it's tenfold greater than what you would see in somebody in groups. You know, when we look at how prevalent it is, it's much more prevalent in for those that age group, tenfold greater than, say, somebody who's 50, 60, 70, 40. You know, it just rifles upward when you go through puberty. That being said, people that are older can have much deeper, much more severe depression and anxiety and problems because of some of the traumatic life events that happen when you get older. You lose a spouse. You know, you think about somebody who's 85 years of age. You've outlived, you know, all of your friends. There's a chance you've outlived your children, you know. And so that lack of social support can be very debilitating. So anyway, so that's kind of a continuum of gerontology for you.
Well, that's very interesting. And that made me think of like a couple different things. I'm not sure if you ever heard of like in social media, there's a lot going on about things like dopamine detoxes. Yeah, and that's something yes. And I'm very interested what your thoughts on are that. And, you know, if there's any, I guess, biological, scientific base to ground that those practices in.
The concept of dopamine being toxic and having to detox from it, certainly the issue is dopamine is addictive, and so those behaviors that release tons of dopamine are what you're drawn to. Absolutely. You know, for me, it's always been my surfing. You know, it's your friends, you know, when you have a great interaction with your friends. Okay. And then there's the design. Okay. That is social media. And so it's an intentional design to draw you in to garner and really suck all of your attention. And then you get these, you know, it seems to me so simple, and I fall into the trap, you know, that they're playing you, but you know, the likes and the smiles and the emojis, and then you get this little rush, you know, behavioral rush for that, you know, and everybody wants that rush, you know, and it's no different than being addicted to cocaine. You know, you get over the cocaine and you feel down and you want to go back and you want to get more. You want to get more. You want to get more. You know, and that's what social media is doing all the time. And it's not healthy because it's not real. You know, it's really not real. You know, there's so much out there. You know, you can get really amazing rushes of dopamine by going for walks out in your neighborhood where there's lots of trees and birds and things like that. You just got to let it happen, you know. But you get played, and then next thing you know, from social media, you find that you kind of derailed from society in a weird way. You know, it's, you're not really interacting with these people. You know, you've derailed from the true essence of how we evolved to be social and interactive. You know, and you know, there have been a couple of major studies. There's a really long-term study on generations out of Harvard where they started with grad students back in the 40s. And then they looked at their kids and they started with 20,000 people. And it all came down to, you know, what engendered, what garnered happiness. And as a result, were the most healthy and long-lived people in the world. So it was a gerontology study. And it always came down to high quality relationships with people, you know, and I just don't think you get that quality out of Snapchat. So I think detoxing, if you can, you know, put your phone down and not be so glued into it, you know, I think it's healthy. It's, you know, I'm sure you've seen it, James, where you go out to a restaurant and you're supposed to be interacting with your significant other, or you're supposed to be interacting with your friends. And it's always, you know, my wife and I always know we are not glued to our phones, but it's interesting to look around the restaurant and how people are sitting there with each other, only in, you know, physically sitting with each other, but mentally they've checked out. They're sitting there staring at their phone the whole time they're supposedly going out for a date, you know. So, so yes, you need to figure out ways to get away from it. So that essence, yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've heard someone said like social media and technology in general has like helped connect us in ways we would have never imagined, but also kind of made us more disconnected than we have ever thought it would. So
absolutely,
it's important to face to face conversations.
I agree. For me, I mean, there are some people that I would never be following what they're up to in their lives. And social media kind of allows you to do that. But there's also a lot of, I don't know, bandstanding where people are being flashy and trying to, and it creates the envy. You know, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. You know, you have the friends that are always, you know, traveling around the world and stuff like that. And yeah, it's fun to see, but then you're looking at, well, God, I don't have any money. I could never do anything like that. You know, and then that creates the polar opposite to dopamine, and it creates high levels of stress, and that's a problem with social media. You know, there are, you know, dopamine is one kind of hormonal system, but there's a polar opposite, and that's the stress hormone system, and it causes complete health deterioration. I don't buy into it. I think we've lost our way, but it is what it is. So.
Right. Absolutely. Something we definitely have to really look into in the future, for sure. And moving on, this podcast, you know, is being recorded at the peak of midterm season. In your opinion, what are some methods that we as students can use to really battle that lack of motivation we face?
Right. You know, you got to ask yourself, you know, why are you even here? You know, I mean, I use that cliche term of checked out. And I think it's a real, real problem for your cohort right now, James, going through college. Zoom, the pandemic, it really changed everything. You know, people used to show up to class and be engaged. And I just have this sense that people are checked out and have kind of lost their way a little bit. And so I think people, you know, if they're, you got to ask yourself, why am I here? Do I want to be here? You know, am I happy with this life course? No, nobody says you have to spend 80 grand a year to go to USC. You know, it's not going to guarantee you a job. These, you know, a lot of the quote unquote friends you're making right now that seem so important, let's say in the Panhellenic system, I guarantee you when you go on to the next level, these people won't even matter to you, you know? And so, you know, you have to really want it. You have to really want to be there. And so that's the self-evaluation you kind of have to be going through right now. You know, yes, it's hard and it's competitive, but is this something you enjoy? This isn't what you want to do, you know? And you know, if you're not liking what you're doing, then maybe there's a different pathway, you know? You know, the other thing you got to do is, you know, if you've decided that, hey, I really want to make this work, then you got to find the tribe of people that are of like mind and that are going to, you know, you can all work together to progress to your degrees and do well. You know, it really is all about the crowd you hang with. You know, if you hang out with people that drink and do drugs, then guess what's going to happen? People are going to drink and do drugs. That's what that crowd does. You know, if you hang out with people that are kind of checked out, but then you're probably going to check out. So it's, you know, you're gonna find the groups of people that are into it. You know, and then the other thing you do is along the way, you know, you're just gonna, you know, you set goals and reward yourself, you know, you set goals and reward yourself. So I'm going to get this all done and then I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to get this all done and then I'm going to go to my favorite restaurant, you know. Even in the short term, I'm going to study for 20 minutes and then I'm going to put on some really good music and just kind of bounce around my room and make some pasta or something. You know? So it's just, you kind of have to, you know, schedule it all out in that way. I think that would be what I would do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think part of what you said about like really finding your purpose and finding your why is, I think, so important. Not sure if you've heard of Simon Sinek. He wrote, I think, the book Start With Why. And in one of his TED Talks, he's talking about this in a kind of different context with like products and services like that. But really with anything we do in life, it's important to start with why. And I think a lot of times people really start gravitating to the what. Let's say, for example, as business students, we gravitate really quickly to, you know, what exactly we want to do. Do we want to do investment banking? Do we want to do consulting or what and such, but we don't, where it's important to really find your why. Why are you doing this? And that can really take you that one step further, for sure.
Yeah, no, I agree. Cause you know, life can pass you by pretty quickly, you know? So, you know, yeah, you gotta be happy doing what you're doing. But you know, you also have to be realistic, and whatever skill set you're getting along the way, they need to be applied. They need to be something that society values and will pay you to do. Because I can't tell you over and over again, I hear, you know, it's sad, but a lot of people graduate and they're having a lot of trouble finding jobs. And it's because their skill set really didn't set them up for the job market kind of thing. And, you know, it's just, so I worked my, you know, behind off, you know, when I needed to, you know. So when I was doing to get my PhD, when I was a postdoc in my early years as a faculty member, I worked so hard, you know, 15-hour days, you know, routinely. You know, my wife, she graduated from USC Law School, worked for a huge law firm, you know, and it was 17 hours a day, you know, and it was, you know, 7 days a week, and it was for years, you know. And then we tried to play hard too, but it was always with the goal. We knew that this is going to, you know, this is, you know, I tell my students all the time, if you really want to make it in life, be independent, financially independent, successful in your profession, there's a good 10 years in your life that are going to really suck hard. And you just have to wrap your head around that. And then the clouds begin to clear, you know, and you're established. You know, like I got tenure, you know, my wife went on, became managing counsel for a large company, you know, we got financially stable, and then, you know, and I started to play a lot more, you know, but that being said, James, I always slid in time for surfing, always.
For sure. Are there any particular surf spots that you recommend?
California. I mean, certainly I'm biased. You know, I live here in South Orange County. I live in Laguna Niguel now. And so I'm really close to kind of an elite area for surfing, just south of San Clemente. It's called Trestles. And it's pretty phenomenal. Pretty phenomenal. It's rock reefs. And there's really, really, for a surfer, perfectly shaped waves. Long rides, you know, and it's beautiful. It's the last kind of, what's cool about it, it's the last kind of bastion of what Southern California looked like before it got urbanized. And so what it is, it's the very beginning. It's a state park, Trestle State Beach. And then that's where Camp Pendleton starts, was the marine base that goes all the way to Oceanside. So it's completely natural. So these beautiful streams come down to the beach with oak trees, and it's so when you're in the water down there, it's pretty amazing. So,
well, definitely want to check that out someday, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, and moving on, how are nutrition, exercise, and meditation tied to mental health, and what are some kind of changes that we can, you know, make in our life when it comes to those things, nutrition, exercise, meditation, things that can really improve our mental health?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, this has been shown over and over again. And, it, you know, there are readouts, too, that you get. You know, I was talking about stress, you know, so there have been lots of scientific studies where you can monitor either the levels of the stress hormone cortisol in the blood, or you can do what's called salivary cortisol. You can just do a swab and you can look at stress and another problem associated with poor health is inflammation. And there are readouts of inflammation that you can look at in the body. It's when the immune system is on super high alarm. And it's very clear that diet influences it. And so there's, you know, all my classes. I remember we had these wellness days at USC, and my, you know, my son's actually a senior at USC right now. And we used to laugh at these wellness days. And so I just made it a part of my classes where we really went in and talked about, you know, practices and talked about the science behind it. And so it's very, very clear that that having a really, you know, moderate diet that's not excessive, that doesn't have a lot of simple sugars, so it's more plant-based, more Mediterranean. You know, what happens is we're able to absorb the nutrition that from the food we eat, in large part because of the billions of bacteria that are in our gastrointestinal system, in our gut. And so we eat food, and yeah, we secrete stomach acid and changes in the pH down there to help begin to digest the foods, but we totally rely on the bacteria down there to break it down, and then we absorb what the bacteria have broken it down into. And then they take their portion too. It's a symbiotic thing, you know. some bacteria are designed to eat sugar. Some bacteria are designed to eat the fiber that you have in plants. Some bacteria are designed to eat fats, you know, on and on and on. So whatever you're eating all the time, those bacteria win and they populate, right? And so the problem with eating sugars and fats and lots of red meat is those bacteria have been shown to be irritating to the lining of your gut and cause the immune system to flip out. And you have this generalized inflammation that starts in the gut and then makes its way through the blood up into the brain. And then your brain actually has a kind of neural network pathway that goes down to the gut that's kind of monitoring what's going on down there all the time as well. And toxins from these bacteria and byproducts of bad things that you've been doing actually will go from the gut straight up the neural pathways directly up into the brain. And it's been shown to be high risk for diseases of aging, but more importantly, it's super, super high risk for anxiety, depression. And so you can control this by having a very healthy diet. It's been shown that inflammation goes way, way down. So, as a consequence, problems like depression, anxiety go down as well. You know, exercise, you know, again, the same thing, you know, it's exercise causes the release of these great growth factors in your brain that help in terms of learning and memory. Exercise actually helps protect you. You've heard about oxidation, you know, and everybody eats their blueberries and things like that, you know, and exercise actually gives you just a little tiny bit of oxidation for the period of time you're exercising. And then the body upregulates and says, okay, I saw that oxidation, I'm going to be better equipped at getting rid of it. And so you then have this arsenal at your disposal from exercise. It's amazing. It's really ketones get released that are beneficial. And then, you know, going back to the stress, that's where the meditation comes in. And exercise is a form of meditation. I don't know what you do to work out, James, you know, but, you know, when I'm surfing for 2.5 hours in the water, first of all, it's a really beautiful kind of environment to be exercising. And for 2.5 hours, all I think about is surfing. I don't think about anything else. You know, that is meditation right there. You know, messy, you can't exercise, okay, then, you know, you go out into, you know, I found the outdoors to be the greatest medium, you know, and you go out there and you just take it in, you know, and listen to the birds and look at how green it is and things like that. That is a form of meditation, you know, or you can use, you know, the tried and true methods of meditation that some of our ancient cultures have used for years. But yes, all those reduce stress hormones. Stress hormones cause problems. There is a condition called stress-related diabetes. And also high levels of stress hormones, people become diabetic. There's a condition called stress-related dementia. All right. So you lose your learning and memory abilities just from the stress hormones. And then clinical depression is associated with high levels of stress hormones as well. So it's all good. Here's another form of, I'm going to try and get my friend to help me out here, of stress reduction. All right. So this right here, let's see here. There's Lucy right there. So that's called pet therapy. Lucy doesn't want to participate. So Lucy's a good girl, right? But Lucy's a German Shepherd pointer. We just got her and Desi, her brother over there, their rescues. And pet therapy is amazing, you know, unconditional love. You know, there can be a pain sometimes. They're kind of destructive because they're young. But these are all different methods that are out there.
All right. It was really interesting, you know, when you talked about, you know, things like stress-related diabetes and depression and such and such. And it's really interesting seeing how all these psychological and biological, physiological things are all connected, and how, you know, stress hormones can lead to certain mental health conditions, which can then like exacerbate these kind of physical symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we could do, like I said, that swab of your mouth and look at salivary cortisol in somebody who's clinically depressed, and their stress hormones are sky high, sky high.
Absolutely. Moving on, how does socialization and a strong circle of friends impact your mental health? I think you touched on this a little bit.
Right. Yeah, no. So, I mean, it's all about pleasure and pain, you know, so it's reward and punishment. This is how we operate in terms of our brain. And if you get lots of reward and feel really good and feel supported by the people that are your tribe, then that just promotes great mental health. You have low levels of the stress hormones that I was talking about that can be so problematic in terms of brain physiology. You have growth in your energizing the circuits that are just being bathed in dopamine by this supportive group of people. And it's really those two things. You know, I mean, it's the yin and yang of brain health is dopamine from pleasure and the cortisol stress hormones that are associated with pain. You know, the pain of loneliness is huge. You know, we have a loneliness epidemic in our country, you know, and it's crazy. You know, you look at a city of Los Angeles that's, you know, whatever I think it's about 8 million people, 7 million people, whatever it is. And people can't connect and are lonely, you know, and it's in that really becomes a problem, like I was talking about, when people get older, you know, because they tend to lose their circle of friends and circle of support. And in your worst case scenario, we saw what happened during COVID and how bad that was for people. So every step of the way, you know, and I mean, I always have a saying, it's like, you know, you find your tribe that's supportive, and that gets you, and you know don't worry about trying to impress everybody. We all want to be liked, but you know, if you're having to really work super hard to impress somebody to like you, then they're not your tribe, you know. And there are people that oftentimes, you know families or old friends where you have loyalty, but they're very destructive, and you need to learn how to distance yourself, you know. I call it shedding the assholes. So, and that's what you kind of need to do.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Really, you know, knowing, I've heard this, I think I forgot where I heard this from, but he said, like, you know, as you go through your entire life, it's important to do audits on your social circle as well. You know, finding people who are dragging you down, finding people that are uplifting you, and really thinking about that as well. Sure. Moving on, in being that this is a podcast, it's targeted particularly towards students. What are some things that perhaps we should warn students when it comes to things like drugs and alcohol, and how that may affect their overall brain and mental health?
Right. So as we were talking earlier about, you know, your age group is super vulnerable to having these affective disorders. And that's when we call them, it's your affect, you know, how well you're feeling about yourself and how well you feel you fit. And that's, anxiety, depression, your brain's undergoing huge development, okay? Huge development right now. And it, as a result, it's that front part that orchestrates this. It orchestrates your decision-making. It orchestrates how you project, you know, in the future. You know, this is all, you know, all the planning and all that. It's, you know, and also it's your, you know, orchestrates your sociality. It's all, and those are so integrated, you know, and alcohol causes atrophy of the brain, you know, it does, you know, and you're going to be, you know, alcohol is addictive, you know, all of our addictions tap into this dopamine system, right? But it's just that certain ones really tap into it. Of course, the opioids, you know, and they're like rocket fuel, you know, alcohol, cocaine, all that, you know, it's basically hijacking the system that we've used of reward to guide our behavior, you know, and this is not a reward, you know, and it blurs, of course, your decision making, you know, it's not the dopamine part, but the big part of alcohol, what it does to this front part of your brain is that it kind of starts turning off a lot of the guard systems that you would have behaviorally, you know, and so you let your guard down, and next thing you know, you start doing things that are really out of character, really out of character, trying to fit in, you know, and next thing you know, you've put yourself in a really vulnerable, high risk place, you know, I talked about it in one of my classes, you know, and when you look at sexual assault on campus, you know, over 50% of the time it's alcohol related, you know, and it's because of bad decisions happening at bad times of night in bad places, you know, and it's tough because you are trying to be social and you want so bad to fit in, and you know, I just want all of you guys to understand is this little group that you're trying to fit in that is abusive in this way is not your tribe. They're not looking out for you. And in 10 years, you'll look back and you think, God, what was I doing wasting my time trying to fit in with these people? You know, you think big picture where you're going, you know, don't be drugged down by this kind of this expectation of peer pressure of participate in these activities. And I can't even imagine. Yeah, it was, you know, when I was a kid, of course, alcohol was rampant and marijuana was rampant, you know, and there was LSD. I don't know if you remember that from the 70s and Woodstock and all that, you know, but that was about it, you know. And then in the 80s, and in came cocaine. And then in the 90s, in came amphetamine, you know. And then 90s in the turn in the 2000s, you know, that's when ecstasy started popping in. But the problem is everything is laced with fentanyl right now, everything, because it's cheap. And, you know, so, you know, you've heard it over and over again, but, you know, somebody tells you, hey, let's do this together. You have to always wonder, is this one got fentanyl? Because it could be life threatening. So, yeah, I just, you know, find better ways. You know, there's nothing better than a really, really tasty meal. You're still going to get dopamine there. If you do it with a group of friends that are your support system, you know, you feel great afterwards. You feel great afterwards. So, you know, keep doing the cognitive behavioral therapy that's going to direct you into these positive ways. Just try and stay away from that peer pressure, because it's, it is what it is. I mean, it's, you know, it's a lubricant socially. Obviously, you know, if you are shy, suddenly you're not yourself when you drink alcohol. But maybe that's not a good thing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you talked about like how alcohol lowers inhibitions. I think it's really interesting how, like, often, I guess, people in my great age group are perhaps a little bit more susceptible to kind of these short-term pleasures and not, you know, considering the long-term effects and downstream consequences of those actions.
Right. I mean, and it's, you're naive to it. It is, that's the reality. You know, I mean, I think about, you know, a big part of development is yes, you have to take risks, you know, because you actually need to separate yourself from being not connected, but being reliant on your parents. So you need to become self-reliant. Okay. And so that's what's happening. So you need to take risks and separate, you know, but you got to also kind of think about it too, you know, and it's a tough time, you know, and you are all of a sudden, you know, you think about James, you know, you were cruising at home in high school and that, you know, you're all good, you know, and then off you go to college and suddenly it's like, wait, wow, this is like cold turkey. You know, especially if you went and lived in Pardee or something, you know, whatever it is, you know, and suddenly you're completely on your own, you know, and making all these tough decisions that you're kind of naive to, you know. So you figure it out, but you just hope that, you know, you don't make really bad decisions to get you into trouble.
Absolutely, absolutely. And just moving on from that, do you have some advice for students right now who are perhaps struggling with balancing everything in their lives? Perhaps they have a lot on their plate when it comes to academics, to perhaps jobs, and maybe even mental health issues.
Right. Well, you always got to take out time for yourself, you know, and do what's right for you. And you know, you're going to have to work hard. Like I said, you know, it is what it is, you know? So, if academics is your, you know, springboard to career, then you got to take it seriously. You know, there are, you know, clubs and groups on campus that maybe, you know, they have to take a back seat. You know, people, there are certain times that these things that are all social have to take a back seat, you know, and I see it a lot, you know. I don't want to blast away at the panhellenic system, but I see it a lot there where people, you know, get convinced that doing a weekender in Vegas is more important than you know, getting their midterm done, you know, in the right way, or preparing for finals and da-da-da. Things worked out for me, you know, James, in the end, but I had to turn it around, you know, and some of the things that I did, you know, that would be equivalent to, you know, going out on a weekender and drinking and da 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 da. You know, I did that just because I was part of this Newport Beach surf culture when I was a kid going to UC Irvine, and having that GPA that was a miracle, that got a 3.0, it was a ball and chain that I stuck around my ankle. And I thought I was going to go to medical school. It was never going to happen with that, you know. And so that's the reality, you know. what seems like, oh, it's so important that my friends that are Sigma Chi's really like me and what I'm doing and at that moment in time, da, da, da. It, you know, big picture down the line, it's not going to get you anything. You know, so you need to kind of wrap your head around what's important, you know, what's the future, and be able to say no to these people that really don't have your best interest in mind.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, the power of no is very, very, and sometimes it's not even, you know, mustering up the courage to tell others no, but to perhaps tell yourself no, because you're so into that kind of all those pleasures and of college life. Yeah, absolutely. And moving on, are there any things you perhaps do as a professor, or perhaps you think professors should start doing to help students better manage their stress?
You just have to be available, you know. Hopefully you can tell through our interaction today, you know, and then you can talk to students who have taken my classes, that I'm approachable, I'm available, you know. I don't have this enormous ego. It's not this us against them mentality, you know, and you have to, you know, so I, you know, I understand, you know, I made mistakes, you know, and students are growing up, they're going to make mistakes, you know, and you have to be approachable and lenient and work with them, you know. I'm a great example of you get second chances in life, you know, and at all levels, you know. I had a dopey dope college girlfriend, and then I got a second chance in life, you know, later on. You know, I met my wife when I was 26, almost 27, you know. And I got a second chance in life professionally, you know. And so you've got to allow people to have a second chance, I think. You know, that's my take home on that.
Right. It's very powerful, yeah. And in all walks of life as well, for sure. And then moving on to our final question, are there any specific resources, perhaps a podcast, a class, music? You talked about surfing, or even some books that have helped your mental health over the years, or that you think you can share with our audience.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, for me, it's always, you know, surfing has always been my thing, always. You know, when I'm having things are not going right, I just grab my board and I'm in the water, you know, and it does center you, you know. You go into it, like I said, instant meditation, you know, you're just out there. You have to be 100% focused and involved in it, or it can be life-threatening, you know, at times, you know. And then separate from that, I mean, I can't tell you how many times when I go surfing that next thing you know, boom, there's a bunch of dolphins, you know, within 2-3 feet of me. You know, it's just amazing, you know. And so you find something like that, you know. Not only eating well, but just getting involved in preparing a good meal and finding your tribe that you'll do it together. It's so much fun to do that together, you know. And these are always, I've never been a big reader, you know, I'm very visual and analytical. That's been my approach, you know, so I've never gone to self-help books or things like that. But, you know, and if you're lucky enough, you know, James, and it's just the chips, they can fall into place, you know. And, you know, I made mention of my wife, and it was like destiny, and it's just incredible to have somebody that is truly your soulmate, that we, you know, and the way, you know, and the way that I've been different than a lot of my friends is that we do everything together. We always have. So yeah, I go on these surf adventures. We would go together, you know. Oftentimes there's like boys trips, and then I would say, hey, guess what? You know, I'm bringing my wife, you know. Or my friends would say, hey, let's all get together with, you know, let's go get a beer and go get some Mexican food down here at San Clemente. I'd be, oh yeah, that's cool, but I'm bringing Julie, you know, and I want to, you know, and you know, every single day we go for about a 4.5 mile walk every single day, you know, and then if you ever come by my office, you would see my office is just all these photos, these pictures that I've framed from the 30 surf adventures that we went on together. And she would sit on the beach. She wasn't much of a surfer, but she would sit on the beach and take photos of me, you know, and, you know, and it's super rewarding, you know, super rewarding. So, yeah, so that's my advice to you, you know, and if, you know, with that significant other relationship, you'll just know, you know, and the other advice with relationships is if it doesn't feel right, you have to, you know, I didn't recognize that early on in development. If it doesn't feel right, it's because it's not right, you know, and especially when it's happening over and over again, you know, you have to trust your instinct on that. So.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to say again, thank you so much for talking with me today and sharing your valuable insights and advice. I'd say from this conversation, one big takeaway, find your tribe, like you said, and also with your soulmate. You know, if you found the one and feels right, maybe it is. Yeah. All right. Well,
perfect.
Thank you all very much for listening to this week's podcast, and we will see you all in the next episode.